Every group, and I stand by this, should have some type of quick win. Every change project, every new employee needs a quick win. The goal of groups is to get something done. Nobody wants to feel like they're doing something for nothing. Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the Fast Forward Podcast. And we are closing out this month's discussion on hope and how to leverage change management models to generate and sustain hope with the Tuckman model. So Tuckman's stages, y'all have probably heard of this, just like the Lewin model, either in practice when I start to describe the steps or because you work with the model by name. Now, Tuckman, this is Bruce Tuckman, who was a psychologist who developed this model. This particular model is very much group-centered. So it's interesting because some of the other models I described, people are at the center of it, but you're really just trying to get to outcomes. This one takes it where the group itself is the outcome. So how the group works together, performs together, feels about one another, all of that is the outcome, which then leads to business outcomes. This is particularly important, I think, for families. I know up to this point, we've talked about individual with career and companies. But families go through these stages as well. And you're going to see it when I get into the details. But especially when I think about my extended family, we have had each of these phases. And sometimes we got stuck on one and couldn't move past it. But if you're trying to accomplish goals as a family and the family is experiencing major change, you can absolutely use this model to create better relationships, to keep pace, and to avoid burning one another out and having people feel isolated. So there are four stages in the original model, but a fifth one has been added on. The original four stages are forming, storming, norming, and performing, and then adjoining was added on as a fifth step. So with forming, the key to the forming stage is to create structure. So what is the team? Who is on the team? And what is the team at a high, high level created to do? So when you think about a team, let's say it's the finance department, we are putting five people in finance, person A, person B, person C, person D, person E. Here are the roles that they play. The purpose of the finance department is to manage the company's money. That's just at a high level. The forming part is important because there are a ton of external actors. And if you are not careful, they will hop right on your little ship and will get you all distracted. I've mentioned in every episode about scope creep, mission creep, vision creep. Managing who is on your team is critical to avoiding that. Whenever I have caught myself completely undermining my own goals and in the moments when I felt hopeless and despair, it's usually because I had the wrong people in my view, the wrong people on my little ship, the wrong people in my ear. And as soon as I cleaned house, purged all of these random voices and got clear on who was on my actual team for this goal, I was right back to getting stuff done. And I think that's so important because everybody who was with you in the earlier part of your journey, even in the last big win you got, they might not be relevant to this part. And if you don't have the bravery and the wherewithal and the fortitude to tell somebody, no, not this time, you're going to struggle, especially as an entrepreneur. The more I get into my business, and especially in this new phase, the less I tell people. It's folks who have no clue what I'm working on. And I love that for me. I don't want to tell you the play-by-play of all my business. Not even because I think you're going to steal it, but because the time I waste trying to explain it to you and hope you get it and hope you on my side and get your feedback, I could have been getting stuff done. And I just don't have that type of time. Additionally, I don't always trust people's motives. One of the things that the last couple of years has revealed to me is that everybody who said they were for me, they're not necessarily for my business. And so there is a version of me that they could get with, but there are new versions that is not on their bingo card of who they want to rock with. And sometimes people are afraid to let you go, so they'll keep dragging it along, but they know it's over with. And if that's the case, sometimes you need to be the one to pull the plug. Now, as a person who is open about my avoidant attachment, I am much less worried about or feel bad about burning bridges as perhaps I should. That comes kind of natural to me. And I've learned to be more intentional about it and repair sometimes rather than just completely destroy. But sometimes it's necessary, and I still don't hesitate. Like, if it really come down to it and I realize this person ain't it, you got to go right away. And sometimes it's just for that season. Sometimes it's just for that project. It might only be for that week or that trip or that month. Whatever it is, you have to take ownership of that. Because as I said before, the purpose of the Tuckman model, the main goal is that the group itself is the change. How to get the group on board with the vision, on board with the goal, not just the outcome itself. The second stage in Tuckman's model is storming. So this is where, you know, you go from perhaps initial excitement about the change or all of this energy, this burst of energy because you're just getting started, to now people starting to get a little irritated, confused, sometimes angry because they don't quite know what's going on. They may not see a place for themselves. It might not be the place that they wanted if they do see their place. And so you are doing just what it says. You're going through a storm. So just like the wind might blow and the rain may batter down, you got to have the right tools in your toolbox to protect yourself and the team. So sometimes that means that you have to over communicate. Sometimes it means you have to draw a hard line in the sand and confront people and say, no, this is what we're doing. Sometimes it may involve you being willing to rework people's roles. And so how you choose to approach things requires individualization. So if you are not a person who sees people as individuals, it's funny because individualization, I think, is my number 7 strength in the Clifton Strengths model. But I know it's in my top 10. It's not in my top 5, but I know it's in my top 10. I love having that because I naturally kind of see people for their own individual makeups. But I know for some people, that's really difficult. So one of the things you can do as a hack to be able to get clear on where people are pulsing, leverage one-on-one meetings. So literally sit down with people individually. And before you start talking about the business, before you start assigning work, telling people what they did or didn't do, start with, hey, what's the top emotion you're feeling? I do this all the time in trainings. What's the top emotion you feeling? How you doing? What's going on? How you feeling today? How did you feel about that meeting? Sometimes having people name an emotion can open up a whole lot of insights, because if they're resistant to tell you an emotion or I don't feel nothing, that's a data point. If they're quick to tell you, I hated that, I didn't like it, that's a data point. And then it opens up conversation. And sometimes their unwillingness or inability to name their emotion, or, you know, sometimes people are confused because they have too many emotions, or maybe they're being influenced by someone else's emotions. All of that is data that you can use to be able to help people get back on track and help get the team back on track. In addition to one-on-ones, you can also leverage that same question, top emotion you're feeling, at the top of group meetings. Give people a chance to get feedback. And also with that, with the team meetings, balance reflection time and action orientation. So there are some times where I might come out of a group meeting and the main thing I want people to do is just walk away with a reflection question. And then other times when I come out of a group meeting, it's like, okay, we need to be doing A, B, and C. Like, even on my own team now, there are times where I'm working with the team and I'll just say, hey, you know, just think about this. Let's shoot each other some ideas in the chat, or hear some articles. Just think about it and then come back to me. Because sometimes people, even people who are naturally action oriented, sometimes people need time to think. They don't want to make a decision in that moment. They might have a lot going on that week. Maybe they don't feel good. And so balancing that hardcore action, 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 action with, hey, let's sit down and think, process this. That gives the introverts time to feel comfortable. And it gives the people who might be prone to burnout, like hardcore extroverts, sometimes they could burn out without knowing it. You give them some time to think. I think that's very important for managing that storming phase. One of the main goals or positive outcomes of the storming phase is that you recenter the norms. Lots of emotional change at this point. People starting to kind of show their true colors. So it gives you a chance to recenter individuals, so you can use that individual recentering to recenter the team. It's just like if you think about a studio where they have all those little dials and things that they switch up so that the final song sounds amazing. Same thing. All right. Third stage is norming. So once you get to norming, this is where folks start to see this is really the main outcome of this stage is accomplishment. So you start moving towards some milestones. Every group, and I stand by this, should have some type of quick win. Every change project, every new employee needs a quick win. What did we get done? Anytime people working on something for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year, 18 months, I done seen folks work on something for 3 years and it didn't lead to nothing. And it pissed people off. Like it made folks really mad. The goal of groups is to get something done. Nah, what it gets done, the whole world don't have to like it or see it as important. But if the group is convinced that it added value and you have buy-in from senior leaders and you're clear on the value add, yes, set up the milestones so that you keep people motivated. I don't care what your personality type is. I don't care how old you are. I don't care what your job title is. Nobody wants to feel like they're doing something for nothing. And even like I talked about in the context of families, what is the family getting done? One of the things that is so interesting, now I'm thinking through this as I'm talking to y'all, but I think back to one of the things that really frustrated me about my childhood, one of the main things was that we just circled in the same little spot. Like we never got real progress. Even when it looked like we were getting something done, almost immediately we would be right back in the same mire and foolishness. Now, some of this was in large part due to addiction, my parents' very toxic relationship, poverty, right? Job insecurity and economic instability where we were living, all of those things, yes. But it's like nobody planned for that, right? Like, at a certain point, you got to know, all right, this is where the external influences are stacked against us, but this is what we're going to do instead. And if I'm honest, I think that's why I'm so relentless about setting and achieving goals. Because I never, as a kid, it was like nothing ever got done. Like we never accomplished stuff as a family unit. And I hated that. And even though, I mean, to be honest, when I think about it, even the extended family, like there weren't a whole bunch of huge, lofty goals. It was just day to day, just getting along. And I wasn't oriented like that. And because I wasn't oriented like that, I would feel so blah. I always just felt like, okay, well, we could be doing this. And you know what? Again, this like my own little therapy session. Even as an adult, there was an incident that happened. It would have been some years ago. And I experienced, let me just say what it is so I can stop beating around the bush on this podcast. I experienced something that was really cool. It was a tourist attraction in the city I was living. And I went to it and this thing was so inspiring to me that I mean, it was like one of the moments where like in a movie, this would have been the climactic point where the protagonist just has their aha eureka moment. And I remember calling every single one of my family members and like calling until they answered this in that moment while I'm experiencing this tourist attraction. And I was like, we got to do something as a family. Do you want to start a business? I know you love to do this. I'm talking about y'all. I was calling like 5 or 6 people. This at like 6:30 in the morning. Like folks was waking up like, what are you talking about? And I was like, we could do this and we could do this and they'd be there. And they were all like, no. They was like, no, man, we're not doing that. And I just remember feeling so deflated. Now, it wasn't just because they were like, I don't want to do that, because people could do what they want. But I think it was more so the point that there was just no urgency, no excitement. It just felt, I think for the first time, because up to this, at this point now, I have been living away from my family or kind of detached a little bit from my family, both emotionally and honestly, just in day-to-day interactions. And when I got so much pushback and resistance, it brought me back to that same complacency that I remembered from being a kid. But because I was so entrenched in my own life at this point, I didn't see that anymore because I just wasn't paying attention to them. Like, I'm doing my own thing. And again, it's this constant pursuit of stuff. And so hearing them just be like, okay, nah, oh, that's nice. And I'm sending them pictures of this thing that I'm seeing. They're like, all right. And I was just like, I don't like this, right? Like, I don't want to say it went as far as being like, I don't want to be in this family, but I think that was probably one of the first times I allowed myself to admit that I am not the same. That the way I approach things, the way I think about things, the way I do life, it's not the same. And I'm going to leave that there. I think I'm done with my therapy session for today. But that part, to me, that was a part of that Norman, where the norm that I wanted, it was clear it was not going to exist on that team. And I love my family. I mean, it ain't like I stopped talking to them after that. I just went on, but I know that that fundamentally shifted how I felt compelled to share myself and share space with them. And I feel like it was mutually beneficial because then they didn't have to feel pressured about me always coming up with this idea and be like, you don't want to do this. And I didn't have to feel pressured or let down by them kind of shooting stuff down, even for me. So I'm like, cool, I just mind my own business. And it's interesting because the ideas that I was talking about then, since then, every single person that I called has called, come back and been like, hey, you want to help me with this? And it was like, no, I actually don't. Like, the thrill is gone. Wish you the best. Hope you achieve your dreams. But I'm off that. And I think part of that is because, and this is for senior leaders, coaches, HR professionals, consultants, in that norming stage, sometimes you will see things in people that they don't see in themselves. And you have to make a decision within yourself of whether or not you are going to push them to see that or whether or not you're going to leave well enough alone. And I have learned that, honestly, unless it's a paying client, I leave well enough alone. I got friends right now. I see so much potential in them. And it's stuff that they said they wanted to do. I would love to be able to help them, love to give my all to get help them get it off the ground. But I know they ain't going to do nothing with it. So I just leave them alone. I'm not even going to judge you. Because for me, that is an inefficiency. Just going back to when I talked about my values. It's inefficient to keep pushing. And I know you're not going to receive it. I'd rather just leave you to your own devices and keep minding my business. And I would rather invest in a stranger who is highly motivated and interested in what I'm offering than invest in people who I know, love, and trust, who I know wouldn't do nothing with it. That's where I'm at in my life. What about you? All right, let's get to this fourth stage, which is performing. This is when, okay, we done got some initial accomplishments, some initial milestones, so people feeling good, they seeing some momentum. And at this point, we want to make sure that we are maintaining the synergy that we found. Synergy does not mean everybody does everything the same, but it means that you put in maximum effort for what you're doing to make sure that the group can maximize its potential. So everybody is not always operating at an 80. Some people might be 10, some people might be 50, some people might be 40, but when we put it all together, the aggregate is that the group is operating at 100%. This requires collaboration. So showing up for one another, being open and honest, being open about wins, strengths, and also weaknesses and where we're failing. If you know that you can't get something done on time, if you know that you're struggling this week, chip in. Going back to the note about families, Brene Brown said something really awesome. I think she was on somebody's podcast. I don't think it was hers. But she talked about how, I think she was saying her marriage isn't 50-50 or 100-100. I forget how she described it, but I remember the example. She said that there are times where her husband will come to her and be like, I only got 20% today. Like, I need you to just pick up that other 80 because this has been a hard week. And then there are weeks where she'll be like, look, I'm only at 50%. I had a big deadline. I ain't going to be able to do it. Sometimes the kids come and be like, it ain't happening. And someone else who I admire and respect, Jason Wilson, who is over the Cave of Adullam, he just came out with a new book, too. I want to get that called The Man, The Moment Demands, I think. But he has talked about how First of all, his whole, he does a lot of martial arts training, mentorship for black boys in Detroit. And, you know, he don't mind pushing and challenging the boys so that they can reach their potential, create that structure that they need, build emotional regulation and intelligence skills. It's amazing. But he talked about, even with all he does, he also knows when to show up and nurture. And so he gave the example of one time his son had, I guess it was finals or something like that. His son's a teenager. And his son was overwhelmed. He had all his homework to do. And normally he has chores, but he saw that his son had been working his hand off that week. And he knew how overwhelmed he was. So he told his son, he like, look, you go play video games with your friends and relax. I'll do the dishes for you. And I thought how awesome that was, because in the context of a family, sometimes you're not firing on all cylinders. And this is one of the issues I have with these conversations about gender roles, where man should always protect and provide. The woman should always be just nurturing and in her feminine and she relax. Sometimes people ain't got it, right? Like, there have been moments where men I was dating, or even when I was married, you know, regardless of how the outcome of that marriage was, there were times where genuinely my husband could not participate 100% or to the level where I was. And so I picked up, right? And if you are not prepared to be in true partnership with someone or with people, that includes your kids, your parents, if they're a part of your core family, don't leave folks alone. Like, period. Like, don't even get nothing started. Because the expectation that people should always be at your service, at your beck and call, and capitulating to what you need and want, that is childish. Only toddlers and babies think like that. Like, if an infant is crying, they don't get what you got going on. Answer my cry. By the time you get to be an adult, you should have been a grew out of that. And I'm just being honest with y'all. This probably needs to be a Dear Little Sis episode. Because I do think that it's very important. One of the things that I always keep in mind is, like, what if people get sick? What if people have mental health issues? What if people lose loved ones or other people? What if people lose their job? What if people experience significant change or some significant trauma? You mean to tell me you're not willing to be flexible at all to support people? You're not willing to show up for folks to maintain, again, the synergy of the group? The goal is for the group to always be moving, the group to always be maximizing its potential, the group to always be accomplishing what it set out to accomplish. That don't mean everybody always going to be able to do the same thing. And as much as you might plan and hope for the best, sometimes stuff happens. Now, if it's always happening or you see that person is irresponsible, that's something totally different. And you want to course correct for that or step away. But if you know that person is generally on point, and they really be trying, and it's like they just got hit. Sometimes you get blindsided. You mean to tell me you just gonna be like, no, nah, that ain't good enough? Insane. That is insane. And you need to check yourself. And that's all I can say, because we would expect folks to be there for us. So remember, in that performance stage, just because you're performing as a group, as a family, as a team, as a company, you still have to monitor that. And that collaboration is how you monitor it to stay there. Finally, and I'll just talk about this for just a little bit. You know, the adjourning phase, especially for short-term change projects, is really important, because sometimes the group will sunset either in whole or at least in that version. So a good example of this would be, let's say, you know, you and your partner have a newborn child. The baby, not always a newborn. So of course, with newborns, they have this crazy sleep schedule, if they ain't sleeping at all, really. Y'all can't get no sleep. A lot is going on. You probably won't have the same needs for your newborn as you do when they're a toddler, or when they go to elementary school or middle school or high school, or when you become empty nesters again. And so that adjourning, for me, one of the best outcomes of adjourning is archival. How do you archive that moment and do a proper, like, closing analysis of what worked, what didn't work? Let people get out their bad blood, their bad feelings, frustrations, all that stuff. Work through it, talk through it. And then in the next iteration, you make things better. I think that's super important for families. And to go back actually to the example from when I talked about my childhood with my parents in particular, there never was the adjourning of a tough moment. And that might be why we kept just like cycling in the same mess. Because it was like we never learned the lessons, right? Like, when I think about my parents, especially when it came down to No, it was with everything. I was about to say, especially when it came down to money, but it was everything, y'all. It was like they never got it. So if they, you know, blew the money doing this one time, we were probably going to have the same thing happen in 18 months. If we got on this one job and, you know, got rolled up for this or messed up on this, the next job is going to be the same thing. And I'm like, why are we not learning? I will never forget. I'm going to say this and then I'm going to close. Oh, this episode longer than I thought. My mother wanted me to write this letter for her. She was appealing a decision on something. And so, of course, you know, even back then, I was like a little mini consultant. So I was like, okay, well, tell me what happened so I can know what to write. And so she starts talking to me about it. And I'll never forget, I was like, oh, well, you was wrong. Like, they should have did that. And she went off to the point, this was one of the few times I thought my mother was actually going to, like, physically assault me. And that part ain't funny. And my dad, this is my stepfather, he had to come, like, physically in between us and, like, tell me, like, go on and go sit down. Like, don't buy. And I was like, no, but I just... He was like, be quiet, go in your room, shut the door. And later I came out, of course, because I told y'all I had a narcissistic mother growing up, saw a type of emotional abuse and stuff. So she guilt tripped me into writing it, all this stop story. So I did it. And I think what I said was going to happen ended up happening. And so she was mad and tried to blame me for it. It was crazy. But the point was, even in my teenage mind, I knew, like, no, you was out of pocket, though, man. I'm like, why you do that? You know what I'm saying? And this goes back to what I'm saying about archival. Like, do you remember the last thing you did well or failed at? Don't do that again or do that some more. Like, do an appropriate closeout. And that just never happened in my family. And I think, oof, y'all, this episode is bringing up a lot for me. I think that's why I approach life the way I do. Like, I am constantly assessing my choices, even down to the smallest things, y'all. Like, I could get a little neurotic about it. This is what me and my therapist be working through. But it's because I saw people just doing the same goofy stuff over and over and over again in childhood. And it wasn't just my parents. Like, I'm using my parents as an example, but believe me, it was like almost every family member. The same stuff. And I'm like, why y'all doing that? Like, stop. Don't do that no more. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I definitely think that there is something to be said for how you archive choices, outcomes, relationships as a family unit, like as a group. Do you sit down and have family meetings and say, you know what, let's assess our friends, adults and kids? Because I think a lot of times adults would be like, I don't like that friend. But guess what? They probably modeling what they see you do with your friends as an adult. And that's why they keep showing up in these crappy friendships. When you make better choices with friends, guess what? Your kids probably will too. That's on the side. But that type of assessment, letting people be honest, it's needed. Because you don't want to keep making the same mistakes over and over again. So that's the Tuckman model. Again, this is a good one to apply in family situations as well as for your business or for your team. Let me know down in the comments, which stage do you feel your team or your family is at right now? What stage are you hoping that you can get to quickly? And of course, be sure to like, share, and subscribe. I've enjoyed this one. Let me know how you feel about this style where I walk through models and stuff. I know sometimes I approach it differently in the episodes, but let me know how you like this month's episode. And I'll see if we can incorporate some more in that if y'all like it. All right, y'all. I will catch y'all in the next one. Bye.